July 26, 1990, George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was and continues to be a long and hard fight for people with disabilities. As recently as 1979, it was legal for some state governments to sterilize disabled persons against their will. Other laws prohibited people with certain disabilities from marrying or even from appearing in public. People with disabilities have come a long way, but when it comes to issues like independent living, the struggle continues. On today's Your Call, we'll look at the past, present, and future of this movement. What do you want to know about the successes, and what stories do you want to share if you're part of it? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Nick Kelly. The president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, says his army has retaken the town of Bor. Mr. Kiir said government forces were now consolidating control of Bor, which had been captured by a defected general loyal to the former vice president Riek Machar last week. The army's advance on the town came as the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, announced the discovery of a mass grave in the town of Bintiu and said she was trying to confirm reports of a further two graves in the capital, Juba. James Copnell reports.
The UN says a mass grave has been found in Bentiu. The town has been under control of rebel forces loyal to the former vice president Riek Machar since the end of last week. The identity of the dead was not immediately clear. At least two other mass graves have reportedly been found in the capital Juba, the UN says. Both the government and the rebels have accused each other of carrying out abuses. The fighting in South Sudan was sparked by political ambitions. But the country does have deep ethnic divisions, and the clashes are making them worse.
Israeli air and ground forces have launched attacks on Gaza, killing an infant girl and wounding 10 people in response to the fatal shooting of an Israeli near the border. It's the heaviest wave of attacks since November last year. Sebastian Usher reports.
Doctors in Gaza say the girl was killed by shrapnel as Israeli aircraft struck two training camps belonging to Hamas, which governs the Palestinian territory. They say two of her brothers and her mother were also wounded. The Israeli airstrikes were ordered by the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu after an Israeli man working on the border fence with Gaza was killed by Palestinian sniper fire. He described the incident as very serious and promised retaliation. It was the first killing of an Israeli on the border with Gaza since 2012. Hamas and Israel have maintained an uneasy ceasefire, brokered after 8 days of heavy fighting last year.
A number of global retailers and clothing manufacturers operating in Bangladesh have agreed to set up a multi-million dollar fund to compensate victims of the garment factory that collapsed in April. An official from the International Labour Organization said an estimated $40 million would be required. It was not immediately clear how much money each retailer had agreed to pay into the fund. However, trade union representatives have described it as a landmark. More than 1,000 people, most of them garment workers, died when the Rana Plaza building in Dhaka caved in. Angry crowds in the Egyptian city of Mansoura holding protests against the Muslim Brotherhood, which they blame for a car bombing that killed at least 13 people. The Muslim Brotherhood itself has denied involvement and condemned the attack, which targeted a police headquarters, causing part of the five-story building to collapse. The Interior Minister, Mohamed Ibrahim, has described the bombing as an attempt to sabotage next month's referendum on a new constitution. World News from the BBC. Italian authorities have begun clearing a notorious migrant reception centre on the island of Lampedusa. There's been a series of protests against unsanitary living conditions and alleged mistreatment at the centre. It was designed as a short-stay facility for migrants passing through the tiny island, but later became a refugee camp. Winds of 145 kilometres an hour and heavy rain have caused widespread disruption on one of the busiest travel days of the year in Britain and France. Both countries are affected by flooding, felled trees and power lines. Rail, air and ferry services have been cancelled. Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the Russian former oil tycoon and leading critic of President Putin, has applied for a visa to Switzerland less than a week after being released from 10 years in prison for tax crimes and embezzlement. Mr. Khodorkovsky flew to Germany after he was pardoned. From Berlin, here's Damian McGuinness.
Swiss government officials have confirmed that Mikhail Khodorkovsky has applied for a three-month visa for Switzerland, where his twin sons go to school. A spokesperson for the former oil tycoon said he intends to move there in the new year. In his first public appearance since his release from prison, on Sunday, a surprisingly fit and healthy-looking Mr. Khodorkovsky said he would only return to Russia if he knew he would be able to leave again. In other words, that he would face no further criminal charges.
And Russia has dropped criminal charges against the first of 30 people who were arrested for their part in a protest against Russian oil drilling in the Arctic. The 28 activists and two journalists were charged with hooliganism in September and imprisoned, but they've all now been freed on bail and are being granted an amnesty. Greenpeace has welcomed the development, saying a stamp on its campaigners' passports, allowing them to leave Russia, would be the best Christmas present. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On July 26, 1990, George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA is a civil rights law that prohibits discrimination based on disability, which is defined as, quote, a physical or mental impairment that sustainably limits a major life activity, end quote. The fight for the rights of people with disabilities was born in the midst of the civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s, and much of it had its roots right here in Northern California. One of today's guests, Ken Stein, has been involved since the very beginning. He says it's important to focus on the fact that it took over 190 years for a civil rights act to be passed and 215 years for a comparable law to be passed for people with disabilities. UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library has a project devoted to the disability rights and independent living movement, which highlights the struggles and victories of people with disabilities. It says, quote, people with disabilities throughout history have been defined as objects of shame, fear, pity, or ridicule. Americans with disabilities have been incarcerated, sometimes for life. As recently as 1979, it was legal for some states to sterilize disabled persons against their will. Other laws prohibited people with certain disabilities from marrying or even from appearing in public, end quote. But the disability rights movement has come a long way. And on today's Your Call, we're going to talk about the past, present, and future of the movement with longtime activists. Ken Stein is a very longtime activist. For the past 10 years, he was the program administrator for the San Francisco Mayor's Office on Disability. His 504 picket sign from the 28-day sit-in for disability rights in 1977 is on display in the Museum of American History exhibit, The Disability Rights Movement. It's adjacent to the Greensboro, Mississippi lunch counter. In 2000, Ken's oral history was published in the UC Berkeley's Disabled Persons Independent Living Movement Project, Builders and Sustainers of the Independent Living Movement in Berkeley. And Ken joins me here in studio. Hi, Ken. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Thanks very much for having this program.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Ingrid Tischer. She's Director of Development for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. Her staff and consulting work has supported free health care services, human and environmental health policy, gender and LGBT anti-discrimination, and disability rights. And Ingrid joins us from her office at the Ed Roberts campus in Berkeley. Hi, Ingrid. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having this show.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Corbett O'Toole, longtime Bay Area disability rights activist. She was involved with the Berkeley Center for Independent Living, the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund, and the takeover of the San Francisco Federal Building with the 504 sit-in in 1977. She writes and lectures primarily on disabled women and disabled queer issues. And Corbett is also in studio. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rose, for telling our stories.
Well, I'm so glad to have all of you, and I'm so glad that we're able to tell this story. You are trailblazing activists, all have great stories. And Ken, I want to start off with you because you have often said that it's true that people do not understand disability issues in a civil rights context. Is that still true in the year 2013?
Absolutely. It's almost as true now as it was 40 and 50 years ago. You know, in the 1960s, we saw people being beat up in Montgomery and the bus boycotts. Everyone understood the African-American civil rights movement in terms of a civil rights struggle. And yet, even though we've had decades of disability rights laws protecting people with disabilities, the media so often still operates attitudinally on the old stereotypes and images of people with disabilities as helpless or inspirational.
And I just want to jump in here. This is Corbett. You know, as recently as the last 6 months, you can look at the news and see that, you know, there's a young man with Down syndrome who was murdered at a movie theater in the East Coast. There are people with autism being killed by family members, and it's not being framed as civil rights. It's, in fact, being framed as, well, they just put them out of their misery. So really different, sort of following up on Ken's point, really different trajectories of exactly the same kinds of violence.
You know, one thing I wanted to bring out right at the top to sort of, I know we don't have a lot of time to talk about something that we could all spend hours talking about, but Eleanor Roosevelt said something once that I think says it all beautifully. And she said, "Where, after all, do human rights begin? In small places close to home. So close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Yet they are the world of the individual person, the neighborhood he lives in, the school or college he attends, the factory, farm, or office where he works. Such are the places where every man, woman, and child seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning there, they have little meaning anywhere. Without concerted citizen action to uphold them close to home, we shall look in vain for progress in the larger world." So I think it really personalizes, individualizes it. Even though we're talking about movements and leaders and history, the fact is it comes down to individual people and individual lives.
Ingrid, what would you like to add in terms of, I mean, there's so much to talk about here, but when you look at how people with disabilities were treated as recently as 1979, when it was legal for some states to sterilize people against their will, a lot of gains have been made.
Well, they have, but, you know, I think that's a very telling example that you just used. Right now, there are still stories going around. There's still episodes of girls with disabilities being sterilized because their parents are so fearful of them menstruating or becoming mature physical women. I mean, to me, these are not historical stories necessarily, but they, as Ken mentioned and Corbett, I think, mentioned, they kind of go under a different rubric because they're family stories. And in many cases, they're, I think, rationalized because people say that, well, they're doing it because they're scared. They're doing it because the parents mean well. When if we really think about those girls, they're not giving consent to that. And what does that mean about us as a culture that we would think that that's a solution to a problem rather than a problem itself?
Corbett?
And sort of following up on Ingrid's point, one of the challenges we're having in America right now is that as certain aspects of healthcare are getting increasingly privatized, there's a bigger and bigger market economic incentive to put disabled people into institutions such as nursing homes. And one of the things we're starting to see from there is that nursing homes are generating income for themselves, the private capital, by doing things like sterilizing people or doing unnecessary medical procedures, because it, in fact, becomes an income-generating system. So as long as we frame disabled people as people who have a problem that needs to be fixed, a burden on society, as opposed to equal members of society who have contributions to make, then we're going to have these kind of problems. I mean, one of the jokes I always say is, you know, I work with a lot of nonprofit organizations, and they're always saying, oh, we don't have enough resources. And I said, great. We have a population of 76% unemployment. Guess what? We have tons of volunteers. And they look at me like my head is crooked because that doesn't make sense to them, that I would think that people that look like me and move like me and think like me are a resource when, in fact, not using that resource just keeps us in this whole kind of deprivation model.
76% of people with disabilities are unemployed today?
People who have permanent disabilities. The federal government measures it as people who are disabled for more than 1 year. So if you see these statistics where there's lower numbers, they're counting people who are in their first year of disability. But once you've rolled off that first year, first continuous year of not being able to work, then the numbers really rise astronomically. But they call it, quote unquote, severe. Mm. So people think, oh, they only mean the one end of the spectrum. But they mean people like me who, you know, I roll around in a wheelchair and I'm not working. So that means I'm a permanently disabled, severely disabled person.
So let's talk a little bit about, and we'll talk about the history in a minute, but what do you think, Corbett, are some of the main issues right now facing the disability rights movement?
Well, you know, what is one of the most troubling things to me is a statistic that came out a few years ago. You know, this week is the anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I'm not, Ken's a better person on the exact year that the study was done, but there was a study done that basically measured 20 years after the ADA and how was employment, and employment numbers really hadn't shifted very much. And for me, what was significant about that was that it felt like a bellwether, that when we look at people with disabilities and we look at society's acceptance of who belongs, and workplace is about, it's grown-up high school. You know, it's like, who's the cool kids? Who can be in the office? Who do we want to be at the water cooler with? And it was saying to me that basically American culture had not yet figured out that we were part of the cool kids. We're still off in the basement special ed classrooms, even though we as a community know that we are part of the society, but the society hasn't yet been able to shift. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that, which we can discuss as we go along in the show. But that to me has been really significant, that, you know, I'm 62 years old and I was born in 1951, and I still go into stores every single day in the Bay Area, and someone says to me, you're going too fast, you know, or watch out. And I constantly feel like, I jokingly say, I feel like E.T., like I'm constantly feeling like I'm an alien in their environment.
This just came up. I notice when I'm on the bus and people with wheelchairs get on, people seem so irritated by it because it takes about 3 minutes. You got to lower the bus. The person has to get on and then they have to belt in. And people just don't, they seem irritated by it. How do you deal with that since you have to deal with it on a daily basis?
One of the things I do, I have a daughter with a disability. And so one of the things as I was raising her, she has a physical disability as well, is that I basically said, you know, we live biculturally. You know, I'm white, my daughter's Japanese, but in terms of the American culture, we live in a disability world. We have one foot in the disability world and one foot in the dominant culture, like many other people who are living in subcultural communities. So that what I do is I hang out with people like Ken and Ingrid in the disability community, and I go to disability events, and I watch Axis Dance Company, and I watch the Sins and Valid performances, and I keep myself fed and honored and seen in my disability community. At the same time that I'm like, I'm out there in mainstream America saying, I'm not going away just because you're making it hard. And I'm going to make sure that the younger people that are coming up can have people like me to say, this is how you manage. Oh, you want to work? Here's how you navigate that. Oh, you want to do this? Here's how you do that.
Ken.
Yeah. You know, and as far as your question, it's a good time to point out something. Jacobus Tenbrook was from the National Federation of the Blind, and they organized in 1940. They were the really first model for disability organizations. So it's a side asterisk way of pointing out independent living disability rights did not begin in Berkeley in 1960s and 70s. There were people with disabilities, there were struggles. What happened here was revolutionary, and we'll get to that at some point. But the thing is, what in answer to your question about people on buses and how they feel, 100 years ago, Jacobus Tenbrook said, of course, we cannot be required to love one another, but we can be prevented from expressing our hatred, our superstitions, and our prejudices in terms of public law and social policy. We cannot require the sighted to embrace the blind as brothers, but we can stop them from placing obstacles in our path.
So what happened? And talk a little bit about the movement that sprung up in 1940. Where did that come from?
I don't know much about the NFB history. I know that they were there. They organized. I know that after World War II, because of disabled veterans, there was a lot of work done to make things accessible. Like University of Illinois, where Kitty Cohn and Mary Lou Breslin went to school, there were curb ramps decades before Berkeley. But that even then, you had to push your own wheelchair to get around campus. There were rules.
This is Corbett. One of the pieces that I think ties it together is Berkeley... The history of the University of California at Berkeley, which was the first UC campus, was actually in the same neighborhood as the original School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf. And when kids would age out of those programs, they would come down to the campus to take classes. So UC Berkeley has been a place that's had people with disabilities taking classes and being part of the campus forever. Jacobus Tenbrook, who's a blind law professor, also worked on the Brown versus Board of Education case because he had a civil rights perspective, and he was a constitutional lawyer. So the outgrowth of the independent living movement, the disabled people who organized on campus and took it to the streets and took it to the city of Berkeley, is a trajectory that has a very deep history in the Bay Area.
And Ingrid, you're joining us from the Ed Roberts campus in Berkeley. The Ed Roberts campus is a nonprofit that's been formed by disability organizations that share a common history in the independent living movement. Tell us a little bit about Ed Roberts. He was born in 1939 and died in 1995.
And there was a lot going on in between those 2 days.
Yeah.
Ken and Corbett actually are probably can add a lot to what I'm going to say. Ed Roberts was, first and foremost, from what I've heard, because I never met him, a man who said yes to things. He was not the type of person to look at things that he couldn't do. And I think most people saw him initially as a man who couldn't do very much, because he was conducting his life from within. I think, was it an iron lung he traveled in?
Originally an iron lung, and then he had a ventilator on his chair.
By the way, those were cutting edge technologies in their time. He was among the people who founded the first Center for Independent Living, which in itself is so significant because it was about people with disabilities determining the course of their own lives rather than being treated either as patients or as perpetual children. I actually want to leave it there because I do think Ken and Corbett can add a lot of rich description to this.
I think one thing we need to think about is what happened in Berkeley, why it happened in Berkeley, and what was Ed Roberts' role in that in 400 words or less. In the 1960s, the campus was going wild with the UC Berkeley campus, with the civil rights movement. Kids had gone down south to register black voters. They came back on north, wanted to demonstrate. The university said, no, you can't. They wanted to have demonstrations at the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco, at the, I don't remember all the places. Anyway, so the university said, you can't have tables on campus. And the famous free speech movement, that people know Berkeley's radical, what happened was free speech movement, Mario Savio jumped on top of a police car and gave his famous speech, when you get to, you know, put your shoulders behind the wheels, whatever. So the university was going nuts. And during that time, what happened? During that time, there was a severely disabled guy, Ed Roberts, and the State Department of Vocational Rehab, now it's Department of Rehab, said, you can't go to school. You'll never be able to get a job. And his mother persevered and said, no, Ed's going to school. Mm-hmm. So Ed got into school. So what do you do with a kid with disability? You put him in a hospital. So he stayed at the Cowell Hospital, as Corbett said. After that, it worked fine. And so a few more kids, disabled students, came in, and it started the Cowell Residence Program. What's going on outside their windows? What's going on outside their windows is all hell is breaking loose with the campus, you know, freedom and civil rights, and they didn't have any civil rights. They were stuck in a hospital. So Ed Roberts found funding to start something called Physically Disabled Student Program, PDSP. where all of a sudden people with disabilities were in charge of their own lives, making their own decisions, a full range of services under one roof. It was real successful. Funding ran out. Funding was not available for non-students. Students were graduating. So an organization called the Center for Independent Living was founded on those very same principles as PDSP. Ed, Ingrid is right. Ed helped get some money for that initial funding. It became the model for 400 independent living centers around the country and an international model for disability rights. So that's when you talk about Berkeley and independent living. Those were the roots, but it was all really had its roots in the civil rights movement and took its lessons from the civil rights movement. In terms of demonstrations, you alluded to the 504 demonstration. So there's a direct line between the civil rights movement, the UC Berkeley campus, and what spread out from Berkeley that made Berkeley the birthplace and really spiritual center of the independent living movement. And one last thing, since we're in San Francisco, I will say that while it's true that the script for much of the independent living movement was written in Berkeley, the stage where it was played out at was San Francisco, in the streets, in the courts, in demonstrations, in rallies. So it's important to recognize that as well, that the entire Bay Area shares in that legacy.
That is Ken Stein. He is a lifelong disability rights advocate. Ingrid Tischer is Director of Development for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And Corbett O'Toole is also a longtime Bay Area Disability Rights Act. Corbett Joan O'Toole. And we're talking today about the history of the disability rights movement, the present, where it's going. We'd love to hear from you. If you're part of this movement, what really stands out for you? Talk about victories. What's next? What stories would you like to share? And if you have any questions about this movement, they are on the front lines. They're, like everyone said today, they don't often get media coverage. When a celebrity is involved, you bet they get media coverage. But not often. They're getting arrested in Washington. They're shutting down the Health and Human Services Department. They're being sent to the basement. So what questions do you have about this movement, and what can other movements learn from the disability rights movement? The toll-free number is
866- You're listening to a rebroadcast of your call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls. 255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you so much for doing the show. What I'm going to comment on is I'm concerned. I've been a member of the disability rights community for the past 20 years, and what I'm concerned about is seeing the change over those 20 years from the true grassroots actions that took place years ago, like when ADAPT was started and they were, you know, blocking buses because they couldn't get on them, similar to the civil rights in 64. But what I've found since that time is that more and more of the, what I call the organized mainstream disability community, is in conflict because they're funded by the government. And if you're trying to protest the government, it's really hard when people on staff, that's their funding source. And this has come up several times when there was a proposal to have people with disabilities protest that Jerry Brown, as governor, was going to speak at the anniversary of CIL. That was upheld, and they, you know, no matter how strong the voices were to objecting to that, there was it went ahead. And there have been instances that I've run. Well, first of all, I should say that when I was interested in doing lots of grassroots work with seniors and disability action out of San Francisco, a friend of mine gave me the book, or loaned me the book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, Beyond the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. And it's edited by Insight, which is Women of Color Against Violence. And it addresses the problems with getting funding from any source that's not grassroots. And I'm also, what would illustrate is that I'm concerned there have been times I have actually voiced to individual members who work for these different organizations and have opposed a policy stance the organization has taken.
And Ruthann, we're actually going to go to break, so I'll be sure to get your question right after the break. Today we are talking about the past, present, and future of the disability rights movement, and we'd love to hear from you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Hey, this is Vice President Joe Biden. Things have not been going very well lately for our administration. But listening to the Capitol Steps New Year's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday always cheers me up. This past year, we saw the Tea Party shut down the government.
And we'll defund, fund, fund, till Obamacare is taken away.
Defund, fund, till Obamacare is taken.
We saw our efforts to oust Bashar al-Assad out of Syria stymied by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Putin on a blitz.
And our big healthcare rollout ran about as smoothly as a pig on stilts.
I don't know how to log in.
Now, I'm not allowed to use this free radio time to announce Joe Biden in 2016, but be sure to listen to the Capitol Steps, New Year's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday, on this public radio station.
You can hear Capitol Steps at 7 p.m. Monday the 30th here on KLW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about the disability rights movement. On July 26, 1990, George H.W. Bush signed the Americans with Disabilities Act. As recently as 1979, almost, 11 years earlier, it was legal for some state governments to sterilize people with disabilities against their will. So we're talking about the history of the movement, where we are today, and what's in store for the future. We've got full lines, but we'll have one open in a couple minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by trailblazing activist Ken Stein. For the past 10 years, he was the program administrator for the San Francisco Mayor's Office on Disability. His 504 picket sign from the 28-day sit-in for disability civil rights in 1977 is on display in the Museum of American History exhibit, the Disability Rights Movement. It's adjacent to the Greensboro, Mississippi lunch counter. Ingrid Tischer is Director of Development for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. She works on a number of issues, including gender and LGBT anti-discrimination. And Corbett Joan O'Toole is a longtime activist. She was involved with the Berkeley Center for Independent Living, and she was also involved in the takeover of the federal building in San Francisco with the 504 sit-in in 77. She writes primarily on disabled women and disabled queer issues. And Ingrid, would you like to take Ruthann's question? It was a big question about the nonprofits and the funding and the conflicts of interest.
Are you still there, Ruthann?
Ruthann?
I'm still here.
Yes, she's still there.
And I might concern a quick follow-up because I know you've got lots of other callers.
Okay, let me just get Ingrid to tackle that one since it was such a big question, Ruthann. Go ahead, Ingrid.
Okay. You know, obviously I'm going to sound like I'm pro-development because I'm the director of development. I've been in fundraising for many years, and I came in through a free clinic and writing grant proposals for that from, for example, Title X money, which is government money. It's an issue that is never going to go away, the question of what funding is appropriate for what services. The thing I'm not, I fear I'm just not in total agreement with you, Ruthann, is that I'm not sure that we can say that fundraising has to go a certain way. I mean, sorry, you brought up so many points. I'm trying to figure out what the right way in is. Grassroots fundraising is a critical part of any organization that works at the community level like DREDF does. However, I think it's asking too much of our particular community to ask that they support it, all of the, that they take on the full funding support. I do think that money from foundations and corporations has a place in some nonprofit budgets. But I think assuming that there's a very clear quid pro quo happening because, let's say, a foundation funds a certain type of work happening, I think is just not, it's not a fair assumption.
I mean, I guess I want to give Ruthanne a quick opportunity to ask me a follow-up question because there was so much going on there.
Oh, thank you very much. That we can agree to disagree. You there?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, it's just that I'm wondering if I would just be skeptical that the movement that Ken was involved in, the 504 sit-ins in San Francisco 40 years ago, and the protest that Rose was saying that she not, maybe didn't physically witness but knows about in D.C. with people in chairs, you know, shutting down offices and things like that, I am just hard-pressed to believe that the mainstream disability organizations would support the grassroots organizations like ADAPT and what they are doing, which has been really effective in bringing about the change more so than. And I am, then Ingrid and I can disagree that I'm just skeptical only because of how much history I know of different organizations of
all right,
and grant funding.
Let me just get a response.
And I work on that with KPFA a lot, but
okay, let me just get a response, Ruthanne, just quickly. So you've got ADAPT, and they do these amazing sit-ins. They shut down buildings. They went to Sacramento to ask Republicans to not cut the budget, and people yelled at them. They took photos of them. What is the status of groups outside of ADAPT? I mean, are there a lot of disability rights organizations out there?
You know, one thing that's real important is the place of grassroots in the mainstream, because the reality is, I believe were it not for the ADAPT demonstrations in San Francisco outside of Laguna Honda, there wouldn't perhaps have been a huge lawsuit and a huge settlement that represented a huge amount of cooperation between the public sector, the private sector, and nonprofits in coming forward with a real good solution to downsize Laguna Honda, to set up community-based supports in the community. So there's to say that there's disability organizations like DREDF and other organizations in the Bay Area doing wonderful things doesn't mean there is no longer a place for grassroots.
I think it's a real sign of our growth as a community that in the old days, in the 70s, you know, if you wanted disability stuff, you had to come to Berkeley if you wanted to be in a disability community doing action. And, you know, now we're 40, 50 years later, of course. Now it's really disability communities. It's lots of people organizing because nothing's going to fit everybody. And what's great about the digital age is that people that have access can create their own communities. And that has been a fabulous boon to the whole field of disability.
I was wondering, what is it like for someone with a disability who's living in the Oklahoma Panhandle, for example?
If they have internet access, it's not a bad place.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Ruthanne. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I guess I've got a few other comments. I'm going to turn my radio down. First of all, I live in Palo Alto, and I'm on disability, SSI. And I will just tell you this. I can't believe how ignorant the city government is in Palo Alto, just with a broad brush, paint them, when it comes to disability. And I've experienced some pretty extreme discrimination in Palo Alto as a disabled person, and have found that the organizations, several of the nonprofits, I don't need to mention them, but there's one in the East Bay, a couple over here in my area, one in San Jose, that are supposed to be of assistance to disabled people, to be extremely problematic in terms of just how helpful they've been. And I know other people have had the same experience. The last thing I want to say is that I hope this is at least generally fits within your topic, and that is being on SSI. My income is $866 a month. At one point, it got up to $907 a month. No matter what kind of progress people have made, trying to get by on $866 a month is absolutely insane. And I would just suggest that maybe, even though I think this is great that this is being brought up, I think people, unless they have really very visible disabilities, there's a the country in a whole, I think, in this area where I live, seems to be woefully uneducated or uninformed about disability. Lastly, I just want to say I wish you'd do a program at some time in the future and follow up on just what people on SSI and even SSA are facing.
Yeah, that's always on our list. Let me ask you, Greg, what kind of disability do you have? Is it visible?
Not as much as other people who are disabled. No, it's not.
Okay.
To most people, I probably look like a non-disabled person.
So since it's so rare to have these conversations, what would you say to people who maybe do judge or get frustrated easily? I mean, what can we do to, you know, let people know that maybe you're not in a wheelchair, but you might have a disability and there's really no way to know it based on just looking at you or walking next to you?
It's difficult. The only thing you can try and do, and I've had to do this, it's a struggle. You just have to be very clear with people about what's going on with you and what your expectations are or why you're talking to them about a particular issue. And even then, you may draw a blank. But, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, it is really hard to be disabled. There's no disabled and poor. Mm. It's very, very difficult. And you're right. It's hard to communicate with people. That's what I meant when I said that people seem to be woefully uninformed. And I think a lot of disabled people are somewhat invisible.
Well, thank you. We've got another caller on this issue, and then we'll talk to our guests about it. Let's go to Pat in San Francisco. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Two things. One, like the previous caller, my disability is not visible, and I'm constantly getting harassed by parking enforcement people because I have disabled plates, or what's your disability? Mm. You know, it's like I've got to constantly reaffirm that, you know, I have a disability, and if you don't like it, it's tough. The other thing is, my wife and I have been together for 40 years. My wife is severely hearing impaired. We grew up in the time back east when they had the so-called special classes for kids. My wife has an educational level of a second grade. And we have spent most of our marriage me pushing her because she doesn't believe I can't accomplish this. I'm deaf or I'm handicapped. And I have to constantly keep pushing her to, you are capable of doing it. This is the policies of years ago, and it still affects people nowadays.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Pat. What can we do to raise awareness about, I mean, not only the issues that Corbett, that you describe, but also people who have disabilities that are not visible.
Rose, can I
So sure, Ingrid.
Thanks. Aside from, you know, raising awareness, which I think there's already a lot of awareness out there. It's the quality of awareness that I'm more concerned about. With the question or the caller who was talking about being on SSA, you know, I wanted to point out that one thing that's really an issue is that even with the level of benefits that are so problematic, there are still basic problems of people who want to apply, for example, who may have visual impairments, who have not been able until recently to get materials to apply that that they can use. So if you can imagine the irony of applying for SSA because of a visual impairment and not being able to get an accessible form with which to do so. You know, we're dealing with really sometimes incredibly basic access needs that are not that difficult, frankly, to provide. It's the question of whether they're remembered and whether there are the resources put into doing so. And including access to public benefits for everyone is a really high priority, I think, going forward for an organization like DREDAS. It's not just the individual. It's the whole way the service is set up.
Right. It sounds like we also need to be a little more compassionate with each other. Corbett, can you talk about Pat's statement about his wife and some of the self-esteem issues she faces?
I want to start by saying that we've done studies, and basically every other person in America has somebody who's impacted by lack of access in their lives. People are not necessarily using the words disabled or handicapped. People are not necessarily identifying as an impairment. Grandma just doesn't walk so good anymore. Mm-hmm. My sister just doesn't hear so good. His wife, you know, just didn't have great education. So I think that we need to understand that basically we're talking about everybody. Everybody knows about disability. Everybody's living in relation to disability, and everybody's impacted by lack of access. If you and I are together, we can't go in the front door of a lot of places. We're going in the back door. So suddenly you're seeing my world in a different way. I think that also we have to sort of spread the idea that, you know, even though Ed Roberts was in a wheelchair and that's sort of defined and that's sort of a very symbolic, it's on the parking signs, wheelchair person. In fact, disability is very widespread and lots of it isn't visible to a regular person. And so we're not used to thinking about it in that way. So I think that that's part of it. Poverty, you know, the problem that Pat was mentioning about his wife is a classic problem. You know, if we send kids, we know this from other communities. We send kids to school, we give them a crappy education, we put low expectations on them, we place lots of barriers on them, and then we're shocked when they don't have job skills and when they can't do higher education. I mean, come on, we know this stuff. This is not news to us. You know, sometimes the disability communities don't look beyond themselves. I mean, certainly the white people in the disability communities don't look beyond themselves. The people of color in the disability communities already know this stuff, and they're actually, in my opinion, leading the way on these issues. Mm. So the problems are old, and we know what they are. It's just about kind of listening to the leaders who right now are the people of color.
Ken.
One thing I'll piggyback onto what both Ingrid and Corbett have said, and that has to do with lack of access. And it's a key concept because the reality is people have all these assumptions about people with disabilities, that it is something inherent with the disability. Of course people with disabilities, you know, are sick. Well, great studies by National Council on Disability and others have shown the problems of accessing health care are not because of problems inherent in the disability. It's because doctors don't provide sign language interpreters. There are not accessible exam tables for women, and women are dying because of this. Yeah. And with this whole issue, to me, it still goes back to that issue of people with disabilities not being a demographic, because the reality is if people with disabilities aren't even listed as a demographic in terms of public policy planning, the public policy planners don't get that there's people with disabilities as separate demographic who are aging baby boomers, and they're aging differently than people without disabilities, that people who are minorities and women have huge rates of disabilities and the access barriers they face. So in terms of public policy planning, again and again and again in studies from the federal government where they don't even list disability as a class that they're concerned about looking at, when it comes to spending dollars on planning, people with disabilities are being ignored and they continue to be invisible.
That is Ken Stein. He's a lifelong disability rights advocate. Corbett Joan O'Toole is also a lifelong activist. Ingrid Tischer is Director of Development for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And this show has flown by, about 10 minutes left. We've got one line open if you'd like to weigh in on the conversation. If you have a story,
you're listening
comment,
to a rebroadcast of your call. So
movement.
Unfortunately, we can't take
of
any of your
there
phone
been
calls.
So many, but obviously there's such a long way to go. What is most effective when it comes to really tackling these issues? The toll-free number is 866.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of your call, so unfortunately we can't take any of your phone calls.
866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. I'll get to calls in a minute, but Ingrid, you brought up the fact that people of color with disabilities are really at the head of this movement.
Corbett.
I'm sorry, Corbett. But, wow, can you tell us more about this? Because that's not something we hear much about.
Well, it's the old story that, yeah, you know, the people who made it. And so they write the stories about what it is. So, for instance, at the top of the show, you talked about how UC Berkeley has this Bancroft collection on the disability rights and independent living movement. Fabulous collection. It's all online. So people who have online access can read the stories that Ken and I have in there, that many other people have in there. However, they have currently collected 114 stories. The last time that I checked, there were seven people of color. Now, I was at the 504 sit-ins. Ken was documenting the 504 sit-in. There were lots of people of color. There were also lots of deaf people. There were also lots of parents. There were also lots of people with other kinds of disabilities.
And the 504 sit-in was the takeover of the San Francisco Federal Building in 1977.
Right. The
there was a sentence written into the section, into the law in 1973 that said basically don't discriminate against people with disabilities. And that didn't get us very far. We needed regulations. President Carter, when he was running for election, said he went to Warm Springs, Georgia, which was FDR's hangout, and said, you know, hey, disabled people, you support me. I'll get these regulations for you. He didn't do it. It got to February. He didn't do it. We said April 7th, you know, do it or else. He went, yeah, 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 what are you guys going to do? And so April 7th or April 4th, people took over the what was then the Health, Education, and Welfare offices at the regional level in all 10 areas of the country. And San Francisco lasted the longest, so we kind of got the big fame for it. We were there for 28 days, took it over, and in fact, Carter forced his HEW person to sign the regulation. So it was a huge shift. And what I think is really important in terms of your question about victories and what's effective is, to me, what's effective is what's effective in all movements, which is when people who learn who they are, you know, we don't grow up in families for the most part where our people teach us our history. We have to learn it outside our own birth families. And that means that we have to find each other. And when we find each other and come together, then things start to really shift. That's how come the 504 sit-in worked, because a bunch of us were in one place at one time talking to each other and believing each other. And that you don't see that much. What I see now is that the autistic community is really the folks, the autistic adults, or they're like, we are okay. They're just doing what every other movement does, which is say, I don't care what the dominant culture says about us. We're going to define ourselves. We're going to move it forward. The people of color in the disability communities have always been here. They've always been working. They've always been defining the movement. They haven't been listened to. The sort of the white dialogue has dominated. They don't get recorded. But you know what? Too bad. Leroy Moore, a fabulous San Francisco resource, runs Crip Hop Nation, writes for Poor Magazine. Mm. He's an amazing historian. He can tell you anything about black musical history in America for people with disabilities. He and Patty Byrne started an organization called Sins Invalid. They put on kick-ass stuff, performance art in San Francisco. I mean, really totally pushing the edge. So the work is there, whether or not it's visible to the white disabled people, whether or not it's getting recorded in the white written histories. No, but now that we have digital access, it's getting recorded by the communities themselves.
We've got a number of callers on the line, so let's try to take a few, and then we'll get responses from all of you. And those are great stories. I'd love to get some of them on the show. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I wanted to ask if it's possible to receive temporary disability benefits for PTSD associated with rape trauma.
Does anyone know?
You know, Ken. I would call... What city do you live in?
Oakland.
Okay. I would call... is it Center for Independent Living's Oakland office? Or
yeah. Also, Bay Area Women Against Rape has done a lot of work around disability, and often they have Patty Byrne is on their advisory committee, and so often they have resources for that.
Good.
Lisa, have you been able to get any help?
No, I haven't. Victims of Crime denied my application for, I guess the standard thing that they do over at Family Violence Center is get you set up with victims of crime, and then they give you some counseling. Mm. But they denied mine because the DA wouldn't press charges on my case.
Oh,
I'm... So I started getting some counseling, which wasn't very helpful. It was basically just me confiding in someone who ultimately, you know, didn't continue treating me because victims of crime wouldn't pay him.
Have you contacted Bay Area Women Against Rape?
Yeah, I have.
Okay. You should, and they should be able to point you in the right direction or directly help you.
They haven't so far, but...
All right. Well, you know, did you have some tips?
I just want to say if Lisa wants to leave her information, I'll hook up with her afterwards.
Okay. Lisa, can you give our producers your information? And we'll definitely try to hook you up with some organizations. Okay. Thank you so much for calling. Actually, I've been wanting to do a show about this issue, so thank you. Let's go next to Eddie in Oakland. Hi, Eddie. If you can be brief, we're almost out of time.
Sure. Hi, this is Eddie. I work with the Disability Radio Program, Pushing Limits, KPFA. So a couple of points. One is we have to be looking at disability as to how to prevent disability. I think the disability community really has to be concerned with that. Like the medical services community, they deal not only with curing sickness, but with curing disability, but we have to really start looking at the issue. Another thing is, I have to agree with Ruth Ann's issue where she's going at the problems posed by the nonprofit industry, disability industry. Is if you're running a nonprofit and if you're getting a lot of government money, how can you does that not determine what your politics are? The other thing is that the disability movement would have happened in any other geographical area, not only Berkeley. It was a function of time and not necessarily of geography. But thanks a whole lot for this show.
Okay, well, thank you so much for calling, Eddie. We've only have a minute and a half left, so 30 seconds each. The other thing I wonder, just quickly, Corbett, is there a connection between the disability rights movement and progressive movements?
There are a lot of people doing that work, yes.
Okay, good. So can you give us your final thoughts? People want to get involved. Where does this go from here? And what's next for this movement?
I think if people aren't aware of the disability rights movement, that it's just the basics. You know, get some education. There's lots of stuff online to read, starting with oral histories. Get connected to stuff you care about. If you're in environmental justice, get connected to the disabled people in the thinking about it. You know, make the connections. They're already there.
And Ingrid, 30 seconds.
I would say if everyone can remember that disability is a word, but the experience is very fluid. It's not a fixed identity, and if you need more information, particularly as a parent of a child who's newly diagnosed with a disability, please go to the DREDF website, and there's lots of information there about educational access and rights.
Thank you. And Ken?
Yeah. If there's one thing to take away, my brain went dead, so don't take that away. Take away the fact that even though we say very quickly, the ADA was passed by George Bush. The reality is 504 regulations became the model for the ADA. Were it not for that demonstration, were it not for the struggles, were it not for the organizations of folks with disabilities passing the ADA, there wouldn't be an ADA. It was not a gift from Congress. It was a people's struggle and was the most successful people's struggle of the 20th century. And it's the most untold people's struggle of the 20th century. So thank you for having this program.
Well, thank you so much. Ken Stein is a lifelong disability rights activist. If you go to the American History exhibit or museum, be sure to see his 504 sign on display. Ingrid Tischer is Director of Development for the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And Corbett Joan O'Toole is a longtime activist writing about disabled women and disabled queer issues. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Parents making decisions about childbirth. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast a conversation about what it means to give birth. Cesarean births are on the rise, and simultaneously, there's a growing movement toward working with midwives and giving birth at home. So how do we make it possible so that we can make informed, free choices? If you're a parent-to-be, how are you figuring out what's best for you and your family? That's on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.